dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. Your CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. Dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Alright, hello everyone. I am Stank Dog and you are listening to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 10. Now, you know that we are without the Wintermute this week. Wintermute is actually going to be concentrating on school, which we talked about last episode. So what we're going to be doing is rotating a bunch of new voices and a lot of new co-hosts into the show. And one of them with us today is, and you're not actually new to radio. You've been on the show before. You've been on RFA before.
Yeah.
So Logan Five, welcome to the.
Hey,
this is your first. This is your premier episode of Binary Revolution Radio.
I'm a BinRev virgin.
Now, well, not anymore. We have popped your BinRev cherry today. Oh God, we're killing the young listeners here, right?
That's not off to a good start.
Yeah,
up a little bit.
We'll just hope that someone's mom doesn't walk in when we say something like that.
It's supposed to be a family show.
Exactly. Now, before we go into, we have a lot of stuff we're going to talk about today with Logan, but before we do, I'm going to do a little bit of housekeeping, because I had a couple interesting emails I wanted to mention. First of all, we talked about the So Big virus. Last couple weeks, actually, we mentioned it. And, you know, I have gotten a few of them, not many. How about you?
I've gotten maybe 10 or 15.
Really?
Over the weekend. I mean, last Thursday, Friday, I got quite a bit.
Yeah, see, I've had them fairly consistently, but, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5 a week for the last couple of weeks. Not too bad.
What's strange is I have about 3 different email accounts, and they've all been going to one of them. And it's the one that isn't really, that I don't use very much.
It's
really kind of odd.
Well, I think we're both lucky, because Hackenslash says he has received 27 So Bigs to his Yahoo account. So Yahoo is not filtering some of that stuff out very well. Now, I have several different accounts also, but I'm consistently getting 3, 4, 5 to each one of the accounts, you know, and it's easy enough to delete them out or filter them out pretty easily, so it hasn't been a problem
really
for me.
Really easy to identify them, too.
Yeah, there's a list of all the different things that they use, and even based on the attachments, you know, if I see something with a PIF attachment, I don't even bother, you know, it's junk, but add them to your kill file list and it'll take care of them, you know, pretty quickly. So it hasn't been a problem. I also had another email from someone who, well, it was from a real name, and I'm just going to call this anonymous and go with it. First of all, he said that we had a great Hackers Magazine and site. Well, thank you very much. But he couldn't find what he was looking for. I was wondering, since you use Linux, if you could tell me how to, or tell me of a website where I can find out how to hack my Sega Dreamcast to run Linux on it. I'm sure it's not terribly hard, but I'm really new at this. Well, join the club. I can honestly tell you, I've never tried to put Linux on the Dreamcast personally myself, but the short answer is yes, there are absolutely ports, there are projects of people trying to port Linux to the Dreamcast. There was even a MAME, the Multi-Arcade Machine Emulator, that lets you play a lot of the old-school games, arcade games as they were intended to be played. It's a very popular emulator, and it's been ported to several. It was actually one of the reasons of porting Linux over there. One of the features was that you would run MAME. LAME would be the MP3 encoder we use. MAME on the Dreamcast through Linux. Yeah, there are a few. I have some links for you, but they're way too long to mention on the air. Probably your best bet or good starting point is to go to linuxdc, as in Linux Dreamcast, linuxdc.sourceforge.net. And I have a couple other links I can give you too. What I'll do is, when Hack and Slash sends the show notes, I will put these links in there for you, so that you can follow them from binrev.com, and you can research it and check it out and actually get back to us, because as I said, I've never done that myself, but I do know that there are people working on it. From what I know, there was a working version. It's not just a project, you know, in process. It is actually working, I believe. But the problem is most of the interest has switched from running Linux on Dreamcast or running Linux on PlayStation or whatever was when Xbox came out. Well, that was just like a call to hackers everywhere. Everybody wanted to put, just for the sheer irony of it.
Not want to.
Yeah. Everybody wanted to slap Microsoft in the face, and Microsoft, you know, basically challenged people, you know, not so many words, to put Linux on there. They said it couldn't be done. So basically, when that came out, everybody pretty much switched gears. So I don't know if there's any progress being made on the old Dreamcast Linux, but like I said, we'll put the links up there. You check it out, and actually, I'd like to hear back from you.
If he could pull it off, that'd make a great submission to BinRev.
Yeah, actually, you know what? That is. That would be a very good submission, a step-by-step how-to sort of thing. And, yeah, by all means, keep in touch with us. Let us know how it goes. Another thing you might want to do is email C4. Go to Gamer Radio. Gamer Radio. Games and More Entertainment Radio at hwhq.com. Send him an email, and since they're more into gaming, but he's also very good at Linux, those guys know what they're talking about too, maybe one of them actually has some hands-on experience. So get in contact with them, again, hwhq.com, and see if they might not be able to help you out. So, you know, I gotta start the show off. I'm not pissed anymore. I'm calmed down now. However, I started off a bad week last week. Just before we were recording the show last week, my fucking machine died again. See, I can't make it through an episode without saying the F word. I'm sorry. But
kids, cover your ears.
I have to say it. I swear to God, Windows XP sucks my cock. I hate XP so fucking badly. My machine died last week. The day that I was going to record the show, I stayed up all night trying to figure out what was wrong with it, trying to back out anything that I've done recently, which wasn't anything that should have been, you know, enough to damage the stupid thing.
But it's the principle that
And this is not the first time, you know? I mean, this is Windows. If you install Windows on a clean, plain, normal, everyday, average box, one CD-ROM drive or DVD, one hard drive, a floppy drive, processor, nothing, you know, just a simple, everyday machine, you know, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. But for power users, people who try to push the machine and, well, basically do what it was intended to do, be powerful and use it to its fullest effect, you know, I have four or five hard drives in this box. I have a DVD / CDR burner combo drive in this box. I have, you know, a lot of temperature monitors and stuff like that in this box. And that's what confuses Windows. If you do anything unusual or anything out of the ordinary, it just chokes on it. It absolutely can't handle it. So I was pissed off. I had to basically reinstall the whole thing. Well, no, that's a lie. I didn't reinstall everything from scratch. What happened was, I narrowed it down to this, okay? I basically, I did all the critical updates, and the critical updates are fine. That's not what crashed my box. I updated everything, but there's also something called recommended updates, which are just other little things. They're not necessarily critical. They're not necessarily security problems per se. They're suggested upgrades. They're not required for you to download. One of them, I don't know which one of them, because I just grabbed the whole batch of them, I think there was like 9 or 10 of them, and put them on. One of them caused my box to not reboot. Now I can boot into safe mode, and when I boot into safe mode, it's, I go through and I try to do a rollback to the previous, you know, before I install all of those. It doesn't help. It does not uninstall things like drivers and stuff like that, which I think is what the problem is. I think there's a driver it doesn't like.
Who recommended these recommended downloads?
Well, our good friends at Microsoft, I guess Bill Gates himself. Yeah. So, you know, basically, the bottom line is I had to get my original Windows XP CD, boot from it, do a repair, and which is basically a reinstall. It overwrites all of your system files with the original stuff from the CD, which ironically means you have to go back to the Windows update to install the service packs and the critical updates all over again.
They're in the first place.
Right, but I just did not install any of the recommended updates. So, anybody that's listening wants to hack me, if you find something in the recommended updates that will actually make my box vulnerable, I'm wide open to it because Microsoft sucks dog cocks. Boy, I really took the show away. I hope there's no kids listening to the show because I really just perverted the whole thing now.
Well, you only told the truth.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, yeah, here, let me give you the short version.
Sure.
Fuck Microsoft. There, that's the short version of the whole thing.
Yay.
And I'm not about to go through one by one. I mean, like I said, there's 10 of them. I could technically go through and install one at a time and see if the box comes back up, but I shouldn't have to do that, and I refuse to out of principle. So, fuck Microsoft. That's the moral of that story.
Always look at it from the perspective that maybe that's what Windows XP is supposed to do. It's supposed to host your machine.
Well,
working as intended.
If that's the case, it does a damn good job. Damn good job.
They're consistent. You gotta say that much.
Yeah, well, yeah, they get points for consistency, but I don't know. I'm tempted to give out the award, but you know what? It's too obvious to give them the fuck nut of the month award, so I'm just, no, that's too obvious. I also was out just kind of play hacking this past week. I was on vacation this week. I'm back at work now as you listen to this, unfortunately. But I was on vacation. I was just out nosing around places I'm not probably supposed to be, but browsing through some servers, doing a little directory transversal, and I stumbled across what I just thought was an interesting naming convention. I found some boxes, some servers, some subdomains, I guess, is probably what they really were. But I'd never seen this naming convention before. Some of the names were Dahmer, Manson. It was a list of serial killers for node names.
Oh, was that Dean in there?
I don't remember all of them. I just remember obviously those caught my attention because they're the biggest names. But I was like, I
wonder what they're using them for.
Yeah. Hey, I don't. You know what? I didn't dig that far. I saw what they were, and actually, it was one of them was a VMS box. Actually, I think it was, like I said, subdomains on the same box. What I think it really was, but one of them was a VMS, and they did have some guest accounts. They allowed you to go in and use and play around with it. And I did that. I haven't used VMS in probably literally 10 years since I've done any real VMS work. So that was actually kind of fun. I didn't spend, 15, 20 minutes on it, and then I had other things to do, of course. But that was actually a fun little diversion. And also this past week were 2600 meetings. And at my 2600 meeting, it was actually, we had somebody from out of town at this meeting, which was very cool, from a 2600 meeting up in Tennessee, actually, who was down here for doing some work for his company, and he showed up, which was interesting. Cy Pete, who is a friend of mine, he did what I guess would equate to a proof of concept at our meeting. He has an article in the current issue of Binary Revolution magazine, Pimp Pimp, about cloning cell phones, and he had acquired a new cell phone. He bought it and basically cloned one phone over to another, and we did it following along with the article basically in the magazine, which I took to the meeting as well. And we basically did this and showed that it works, that it can be done, and that it's true. These things, we verify these. They actually work.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, and that was really fun. So I found that very interesting, and, again, we verify all these things. They actually work. This is not just BS. We actually check up on this stuff, so that was very cool. Now, speaking of BinRev, I don't have to ask what you've been doing for the last week or the last month, because we all know what you've been working on.
With the pages.
Oh, man, I know. And I say it again, I'm going to say it to you, our live on the air, well, pseudo-live. Thank you so much, because I do know how much it entails to go through all that kind of stuff. It is not a fast process, and it's so make it up as you go along and winging it, and it comes out looking so professional and so well done. I know we plan some things out ahead of time, but then at the last minute, it ends up putting you on the spot, and that's probably my fault. It was like, oh well, we didn't think about this, and oh shit, we left out that. So thank you so much for coming out. 1.2 is phenomenal. The cover...
It's honestly, it's a blast to work on. It it's really a nice diversion from my day job. I mean, I do that pretty kind of thing all day long, but this is stuff I get to have fun with. I have an interest in it. I actually learn a lot as I'm putting it together because I kind of get, you and I kind of get the first crack at the articles and stuff.
Right, right. And you know, this Duell said he kind of likes the surprise, the feeling of surprise. He actually helped do a lot of editing on it this time, too. But he said he kind of liked that feeling of being surprised by our own zine, which I understand. But yeah, you and I see it through the whole process and work on it from day one. And I'm glad you mentioned, too, about, you know, everybody knows my day job. I'm a computer programmer by day, and I'm a computer programmer by night, you know. But it really is different. You know, people joke about, what do you do when you get off work? Well, I come home and I get on the computer some more a lot, you know. It's like, I like that. It's a different environment, and you're doing something you want to do as opposed to something you have to do. And it really is. It's a diversion for me, so it's not, I don't think of it as work. I think of it as a diversion of having fun and giving back. And I'm glad that you said you feel the same way, because sometimes I feel like, you know, this is a lot of work. I know it, and I don't want to burden you too much. So I'm glad you actually enjoy doing it.
And it is a lot of work, but it's worth it, because not to pat myself on the back, but I like how the magazine looks. I like the content. I like everything about it.
Yeah, I agree.
It wouldn't be such a great, you know, not to use the term as a product, but it wouldn't be a great product without all the effort that everybody puts into it.
Right. No, we do. We work hand in hand. I have ideas, some good, some bad, and same with you. And, you know, it's like we work together, we mesh together, and so far, you know, we've been able to put it together into a great magazine. I mean, the cover, the ideas for the cover, we hammer out together. We'll start with a vague concept and hammer it down. And even with that, when you still sent me the cover, I was still shocked. I was amazed, you know, at the cover. So,
glad everybody likes that, you know.
Yeah, it's, you know, the thing is, and that's why it's a combination of the two. People say, you know, I've heard comments of people saying that, you know, all flash and no content. Sometimes they hear, not about us per se, but in general, you know. Well, you got to have something. You've got to make it look good. You've got to make it look professional and look like you care about what you're doing, what we do. So when people see that cover and they see, and we'll use 1.2, when they see Tux on the cover, when they see the Linux World Tour, they say, hey, I wonder what's inside. And then when they open the magazine up and they see the content and the design and the layout, it's the whole package. Neither has any priority over the other. You have to put it all together.
Yes, they're all part of the whole.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, you got to put asses in the seat. So I think the combination of the two of them is what's working. And I'm not going to go, I won't branch into this too much, but I'll just say other people are stepping up their game, in my opinion, as a result of what we've done. So I've seen improvements in other...
I've noticed it, because we talked about that a little bit.
Yeah, we won't mention any names. Why don't we go into talking about... And let's talk about some of the things that are necessary in putting together a actual, physical, printed magazine.
Technical manual.
Like, for example, why don't you... this is going to be a lot of you talking. I'll just kind of... I guess play the interviewer here. What software do you use to design and lay out and stuff like that? We know they come out as PDF files, but why don't you give us an idea of how you design and lay out and stuff like that?
Well, I get fed all the articles, but they're basically raw text ASCII files, which is great because there's no fonts or anything to deal with. I take all the text, and basically I use three programs, Photoshop, Adobe Photoshop, Adobe Illustrator, and Adobe InDesign. But everybody knows what Photoshop is. It's graphic manipulation.
Right.
Illustrator is I call it a drawing program. It's what they call a vector-based drawing program. That's what I do all the logos in. Because when you do you can't really do a logo very well in Photoshop just because of the way the text will render, and it looks a little funky. You really want to draw that kind of thing in Illustrator. It's a lot better for that.
Okay.
And to put the actual pages together, InDesign is a professional page layout program. If anybody's ever heard of Quark Express.
Right, I remember Quark.
Yeah, it's basically the same type of program as Quark Express. I mean, Quark is the industry standard for professional printing. Any magazine, book you buy, it's going to be laid out in Quark. InDesign has been around for... I want to say maybe 4 years now, and it's really catching up to Quark. It's so much better than Quark now. You can do so much more with it. And those are basically the three that I use. They're not cheap, but that's where the quality comes through.
Right. Well, you know, to a certain extent, you get what you pay for.
You get what you pay for. And the other thing is, I mean, right now we're not to the point where we're sending these out to have thousands and thousands of copies printed. We're basically making the PDFs and taking them to where, you know, Kinko's or wherever to have them printed.
Right.
But if we were to, say, get a major distributor that would be able to supply us with it with some sort of distribution network where they were getting 1,000 to 2,000 copies, we couldn't do that. We couldn't take a, Microsoft Publisher file to a printer and say, print 1,000 of these. They're going to throw you out. Because they only, I mean, Quark and InDesign are the industry standards. So any files that you make with that, they're going to want those.
Right, and you, since you touched on that topic, the printing aspect of it. Now, I mean, we go to Kinko's. There's nothing complex or magical about that. We go to Kinko's just like, you know, the 14-year-old kid who has to go make copies for his class for, you know, photocopies. We go to the same place. They provide other services, but they really don't do printing. They outsource it to other printers. We cannot directly go to printers, or at least I've tried. I drove around to probably a dozen different printing companies in the phone book.
And I'll bet they told you that they won't even talk to you unless you're going to print at least 1,000 of them.
Exactly. One of them would do it for 500, but he wanted a setup, what do they call it, to make the plates?
Plates.
Yeah, to make the plates.
When you get something printed, that's where, I think, 75% of your costs come from.
Yeah, I mean, and it was just...
Plates.
There's no way around saying this. I couldn't afford it.
No.
I couldn't afford to do it. So we do go to Kinko's with the PDF file, with the final proofs of the magazine, and have it printed out and stapled, folded. Yeah, another thing that I didn't realize was, you know, I was imagining, okay, I'm going to try to cut the cost as much as I can and do as much myself as I can. Well, when you staple all those pages together, A, it's not as easy to staple them and keep them straight and in line. And I went through folding the first batch. I folded by hand, and oh my God, I'll never do that again unless I have to. That was a pain in the butt. And then you have to trim it, because when you fold all that paper, it sticks out in the middle and it doesn't look nice and trimmed and cut. So that's another service that Kinko's provides.
And all that adds up, because right. if you I think we figured out it's averaging us a maybe $285 or $385.
It was dual. I think was $385 for printing
per
plus
copy.
Plus that was not counting. And he could correct me maybe next time. I'll get exact numbers. That was not including like the trimming, the stapling, the print, the folding, etc., etc. So all in all, I know one batch he printed like I think 5 or 10 on a small batch, and it ended up costing him over $5 a piece.
Yeah, which, so, I mean, and we're only charging $5 an issue.
Right, and so, basically for me, it's costing about $475, $485 an issue, so I'm, you know, that little bit of money, we, you know, it's not like we're making anything on the whole.
And then, you know, we really want people to understand that we're not, you know, $5 might seem like a lot compared to some other publications, but it's really not. I mean, when you consider what we're working with and what we put into it.
Right, and don't be misled. I'm not in any way, shape, or form complaining that we're not making money. I don't care if we make money. I just want people to understand exactly where the balance is. So, you know...
Yeah, that's the kind of point I was getting to, is that,
right,
you know, what we're charging and what our production costs are, if you want to call it those, they're pretty much the same.
Yeah, now, we would like to, hopefully one day, if we get enough interest... Let me back up. The way to get this out, people say, you know, if you want to make it big, somebody mentioned that, if you want to really, you know, get out there and become something or make the magazine, to do that, you have to have your magazine carried by a distributor. And I've contacted distributors as well. Basically, they don't even want you to waste their time or talk to them unless you can show that there is enough interest in the magazine to make it worth their while. They're in the business of making money. And if they are going to distribute your magazine and put it on store shelves, they want their cut. And if you don't prove to them that the people are going to buy it off the store shelves, they don't have any interest.
Right,
so that's why we have to start with the nature of what we're at now. I know a lot of people don't want or like to use PayPal right now. Well, that's the only economically feasible alternative. When we get it established and show that there is a market and there is an interest for this type of thing, then we will move on to the next step. I would love to let people send me money and have subscriptions for it where I could just automate the whole thing, but that's just not economically feasible right now because it just costs too much money on our end to try to set all that stuff up.
Time-wise, too, because none of us do this full-time.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is all that we mentioned before, the cost of this has nothing to do with the time that it takes. You know, we have real-life gigs on top of all this, so... yeah, there's really a lot more to it than I think people realize, and that's why I'm glad to have you on so we can talk about this together. Now, eventually, if we can get a distributor interested and get this thing out to stores and stuff like that, distributors usually have contacts with printing houses and stuff like that, and they will take some of that burden away from us. And it will be a kind of a situation where we say, okay, here are the final PDFs, here's the final output, here is the magazine in electronic form, go print it, and they basically act as an agent or negotiate. They have it printed. They'll tell us how much it is. They'll take their cut, their percentage off the top, and, you know, if there's anything left, which, again, is going to be very little, would come back to us, which we would in turn reinvest into upgrading the magazine, buying new software, equipment, stuff like that, hosting fees, things like that. So that is the ultimate goal, but we have to get there, and it's going to take, you know, spreading the word.
Have to walk before you can run.
Absolutely. You get the word out there to people. You get people coming to the site, ordering the magazine, if they like it, of course. You know, people come in and try one, see if you like it, and as we grow, hopefully we will move in that direction. That is our intent. But, yes, you have to crawl, then walk, then fly, and, you know, right now we're crawling.
But we're doing a good crawler, though, I think.
I like it. The feedback has been good. The majority of people who have actually tried it have liked it. The problem is getting more people to try it. So, you know, I guess that's really the case with anything in the world, any business, any getting any kind of, even the electronic zines, even e-zines, you got to get the word out and get people to come by and try them.
Exactly.
So, well, let's go also talk about, now, well, first of all, I don't think we said this officially, but just for the record, Adobe Illustrator, Adobe Photoshop, and
Adobe InDesign.
InDesign. Those are all on the Macintosh.
Gotcha. I mean,
you do
Windows
everything on the Mac.
But I've been a Mac user for 20 years, and BinRev is 100% produced on a Macintosh.
Woohoo!
Woohoo!
Now, 5 years ago, we would have been laughed out of the room for saying that. But Mac kicks ass now. I love Mac. You know, I tell you what, why don't let's jump into the Mac for a little bit in general. Can you tell me this, is this, because I'm developing this opinion on the Macintosh, and I'm not sure, being that I have very limited knowledge of the Mac, and you use it a lot, is the Mac the one computer to rule them all? Is it the end-all be-all? Because, correct me if I'm wrong here, with the Macintosh, obviously you can run Mac software. You have Virtual PC where you can also run Windows software, is that correct?
You can run Windows. Under Virtual PC, you can run any version of Windows. You can run them simultaneously. You can run basically any x86 Linux distro side by side simultaneously with Windows and everything else. Plus, you can run basically any Unix Linux app under what they call the X11 Windows system. You can run pretty much anything.
Can you download source code?
You can download source code.
And compile it for, you know, Linux source code, and compile it for the Mac.
Yes. Yes. There's a developer tool. Apple has what they call the Apple Developers Toolkit, and it's actually a free download. I think you have to go to their website. It's a free download. It's huge, though. But if you buy a copy of Mac OS X from the store, it comes with it on a CD. And there's a compiler in there. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. You just install it. And it's basically what you need to do that.
Well, see, there's a term that people throw around the computer industry called the killer app. Everybody wants to know what's the next killer app. The last killer app was supposedly spreadsheets. I would actually debate that it's games. A killer app is something that's going to make people want to buy computers, want to buy hardware to run that application. When spreadsheets came out, they were so incredibly useful to financial organizations that everybody had to have a computer so that they could run spreadsheet software because it made their life so much easier.
Right.
I say the same thing about games. Games and get customized machines for gaming have been the biggest selling thing that's kept the computer industry afloat, in my opinion, the last few years. it looks to me, and maybe I'm wrong, but it looks to me like Mac OS X is the killer app. It's one computer that can run any and all, almost any, and I'm sure there's exceptions, any and all software on one machine. Why would you need those other boxes?
Yeah, it's really kind of unique when you think about it. I mean, so many people are looking for an alternative to Microsoft, and there's one staring them right in the face. I mean, OS X, it's open source to a certain degree, which is great. I mean, it's not 100% open source, but it's customizable enough that you can basically run anything you want. I mean, I've got my little iBook sitting here in front of me. I've got OS 9, the old Mac OS on there. I've got OS 10. I've got Virtual PC. I've got, within that, I've got Red Hat Linux. I've got two different Windows setups on that. And I've got the X11 installed, which I've got KDE running, actually, right now. KDE on a Mac, which is very cool. And I can access, it's basically just like having a Linux box. You've got all the Linux, Unix apps, you know, with a GUI on top of them. Plus, I've actually got Linux running on this thing. I've got, it's called Yellow Dog Linux, which is basically a version of Red Hat that's ported to the Mac. And all I have to do is reboot, and I just hold down the Option key, and I can select which partition I want to start up from. I can just select a Linux partition, and bam, I'm in Linux.
Hmm.
So there's, in the scientific community, it's really, really becoming very cool to see these people that are ditching their Windows machines. They're going out and buying a G4 and run OS 10, and they can run their computations, anything that they need to do in the Windows machine, but they can also use all these really great, I guess there's a lot of scientific programs out for Unix, and have been for many years. With a Mac running OS 10, you can have the Unix applications running, and then if there's something that you need that's specifically Windows, you can run that in Virtual PC. And so you're seeing these entire science departments that are ditching their PCs and buying Macs, where they might have had, say, a Windows workstation and a Unix workstation. They're basically getting one machine in one package.
All right, well, consolidating down to one machine,
and
sure.
And they love it. They love it.
Now, well, okay, now, obviously you're partial to the Mac. You have a lot of experience with the Mac. But let's, you know, we're not completely brainwashed to only follow. Let's be realistic now. Honestly, running Virtual PC, you're going to take a performance hit. That's
a big performance hit.
Now, how big, for example, I'm assuming that you probably couldn't play some games using Virtual PC on a Mac.
See, that's the thing. You really wouldn't want to use Virtual PC to play games with.
Right.
I mean, if games are your thing and that's what you want, you're better off buying a gaming machine.
Dedicated.
Right. Where Virtual PC is really what it's designed for is if you have a specific program, say business, taxes. Let's use tax software for a big example.
Okay, right, sure.
For whatever reason, nobody makes a home business version of tax software. They used to. I think it was Intuit used to make, whatever their tax program was. But right now, the only ones that are making...
Intuit makes TurboTax.
TurboTax. That's the one I'm thinking of. They don't make a home business version for that. They only make a personal version. So when I did my taxes last year, I had to go... I actually used H&R Block. I'll just use it as an example. I went to their website, downloaded the Windows version of the program I needed, installed it in the Virtual PC environment, and I did my taxes that way. That's what Virtual PC is for. It's not really for gaming, but if you have a program that you absolutely have to have that is only available for Windows, that's what it's designed for.
Right.
I also use it for website testing because I do a lot of website design. That's basically my bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
I could design a site in my Macintosh, and everything looks great. The JavaScripts work great. The style sheets work great. But if I were to try and say IE6 in Windows 98, it could be rendered completely different, but I would never know about it unless I go and test it. I'm not going to go buy another computer just to test websites with. So I have Virtual PC and a couple different machines loaded with different versions of Windows and different web browsers, and I test all the sites, and I can see how it's going to look to a Windows user without actually having to have a Windows machine.
Okay, how about this? Let's say you've convinced me, and you have, honestly, well, I kind of was leaning this way anyway, of looking into buying an iBook. We're buying what would be the cheapest? Now, this is the only knock I have against against Apple. No one can make a Mac but Apple. You know, they've never, there are no clones, there are no other companies that can make and compete on price. You have to buy it from them, which kind of sucks a little bit.
Well, I don't really see that as a down point, because for me, I want to know that everything's going to work when I use it. I want to know that when I install something, it's going to work with a computer. I don't have to worry about finding, going to three different websites to download drivers or, oh, God, I need this patch. It just works.
Yeah, I mean, that is because it's an absolutely controlled environment. But the reality is, if IBM had taken that same mindset and only developed the PC themselves, and no one ever could make a PC other than IBM, do you think you'd really be able to buy a $400 e-machine today that's fully functional, 2 gigahertz box with everything included for $400? I mean, it really, the competition for the hardware helps the consumers. But yes, there is a cost, and that is stability. That's absolutely true. My question is this: how cheaply could I, or anybody listening, let's say we wanted to do what I suggested, let's have a one OS to rule them all, one box, and run virtual PC and have it all centralized, how cheaply could I get a laptop, say minimum requirements or you know, recommended requirements to run OS X and do the things we talk about? Now, obviously, the faster, higher end you get, it's going to be faster and more efficient. But what would be like the minimum? How would I get on board to try that? How much am I going to?
$1,000.
$1,000.
I think the 12-inch iBooks. I think the 12-inch iBooks are about they're just $9.99. I think is what they sell for.
And that's brand new?
That's brand new.
What about like on eBay or something like that? Used?
But you probably find them a little bit less. But honestly, Macs hold their resale value. That's what a lot of people don't realize. You can buy a 3-year-old machine that's less than, it's a little bit more than half the cost of a brand new one. They don't lose their value the way a PC does. You can buy get really good prices on used Macs, but if you look at what you're paying for a used one, it's not that far off from buying a new one.
Interesting. So, and that would of course come with the license for OS X. Is included in the cost, correct?
Right. And the way OS X works, there really isn't a licensing per se. I mean, you buy it and you can use it, but they don't control it the way Microsoft does. There's no serial number you have to enter if you reinstall it. If your drive gets hosed and you lose everything, I don't know. I know that there's some problems with Windows XP in particular. There's a key code or something that if you lose that, you have to call Microsoft to get it.
Yeah.
You don't have any of that. The only time you have really anything to enter a password is if you're using Mac OS X server. But the basic desktop client version of OS X, if you spent $129 is what it costs, you can install that as many machines as you want. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. The licensing agreement says you can only install on one machine. But there's nothing physical, there's no coding, there's no password to prevent you from installing it on 10 machines in your house.
All right, but again, it basically comes with it when you buy it. You're basically paying for the whole package to have the license anyway.
Right.
So whether or not they track which, you know, whether you use the same disk on two systems or not, you already paid for it for two systems regardless.
Paid for it, and
so
they don't really track.
So it's kind of silly, right.
And the thing is, a lot of the software that you're going to want to use is already, it's part of when you buy the computer. I mean, you buy the computer, you can open it up and literally you can get online, you can make a movie, burn DVDs right out of the box. You don't have to buy or add anything extra. It's pretty cool.
What about virtual PC?
Virtual PC, you have to, that doesn't come included with it. I mean, that's an actual separate program you have to go out and buy separately.
Right.
Now, this is very interesting. This is something that, you know, people don't realize. There's a company called Connectix. They're the ones that created virtual PC and sold it for years and years and years.
Right.
Back in February, Microsoft bought virtual PC from them. Microsoft now actually owns the technology for virtual PC, and they have complete control over it.
How convenient.
I'm smelling abandonware here. If you want virtual PC, I would get it as soon as you can. Because I don't see a big future for it if Microsoft has it.
Get them while they're hot.
Because I don't know, there used to be the same company, Connectix, made a program called Virtual PlayStation. which would let you play virtual PlayStation games on your Mac.
Yeah, then they got sued. They got in trouble for that,
Sony
didn't they?
Sony got a cease and desist for it. They fought for about a year and a half or so. Kinectics finally won and was able to put it back on the market.
But by then, PS2 and stuff, the next generations had come out.
I think it was just before the PS2, actually. But Sony ended up buying the software from Kinectics. And then as soon as they bought it, they shelved it. Never heard from it again. So if you can't beat it, and you buy it, and then you abandon the product.
And even, and which is exactly what you just said with Microsoft, but even if they hadn't done that, like you said, either the PS2 was getting ready to come out or was just out, by getting that injunction against it and making them stop for a year and a half, the damage of holding that up, yeah, they eventually won. They were in the right. They were found to be legally able to do what they did. But it's a year and a half later, and your entire market is gone. It could have cost them millions of dollars. The damage of doing these kind of lawsuits, and I think there needs to be a punishment to companies that do that. I think these things need to have better time limits. You can't have an injunction stopping the distribution of this product for a year and a half. That's
ridiculous.
Because
that interferes with the market.
Yeah, that's...
And kind of along the same lines, getting back to Virtual PC, there was another company, and it was FWB Software. They make hard drives and diagnostic software for hard drives. They actually had a comparable product called Soft PC, I think it was called. Basically another Windows-type emulator. And were supposed to be developing a new OS X version of it, but they just announced that that's not going to happen, basically because of the licensing issues with Microsoft.
Mm.
So, I mean, Microsoft purchasing Virtual PC basically killed the competition.
Yeah,
for that emulator market.
You know, I know a lot of people don't like seeing or hearing these news stories and headlines, was like about what company's buying what and who's investing in who and what company's eating up another country and combining, blah blah blah. I know it kind of sounds boring on the surface, but you got to realize that the damage and the reasoning behind some of this stuff, like the whole SCO thing. Oh, my God, I don't even want to start on that on this episode because I'll just go off on that.
What people don't realize is they may not think it affects them, but it really does.
It absolutely
does. Every time you go to the store, every time you go to the gas pump, every time you make a phone call, it has a definite impact on you, and you have to be aware of it.
Yeah, I actually mentioned that in my cyber law class. I mentioned I started the new cyber law class, and I brought that up in class, and I was surprised that nobody had heard of it, or they didn't know the details of it. Somebody said, oh yeah, I heard something about that, but they didn't know the details of it. So I mentioned that in class, so I think I opened a lot of people's eyes, hopefully, and explained. And the funny thing, and I'm sorry to take this off on this tangent, but it just popped into my head. The funny thing is the instructor herself had not heard of it. She's a lawyer who knows cyber law, but she's not a tech person, so she had not heard of the story either. But the funny thing was that I told the whole story. I explained, you know, the whole situation. And again, I'm not going to rehash it all here. But I also, everybody was kind of, you know, found it interesting. There were a couple questions, and she raised her eyes, was like, wow, that's interesting. I snuck in at the end, since they did seem interested, I added that little conspiracy theory about some people thinking that Microsoft may be... the conspiracy theory that they're hoping that they get bought up by IBM or Microsoft or one of those companies. Microsoft has already just decided to license, so that was a stretch anyway. But IBM possibly buying SCO to avoid the lawsuits and the licensing fees, it might just be cheaper and easier for them to just buy the company up, and a lot of people think that conspiracy. Huh?
If you can't beat them, buy them.
Exactly, and... The funny thing is I mentioned that to my instructor who knew nothing about this, knew nothing about it, and I even prefaced it by saying, listen, this is a conspiracy theory. This, you know, I'm not saying this is right. I said, but some people think this, and she kind of rubbed her chin, and she said, you know what, that's absolutely not a far-fetched conspiracy theory at all.
It's not.
And I was surprised that someone who was not on the inside, because, you know, we have a tendency to get biased, a little bit biased sometimes because we're so... You know, we have such loyalty to some of these things.
So close to everything.
Exactly. When an outside person also agrees and says, you know what, that does sound pretty realistic. There's some credibility to that.
Definitely.
All right, I didn't mean to branch off of that, but I think we kind of beat a dead horse anyway. I mean...
I just want to... One more thing about the Virtual PC is that, honestly, most people I know that use Macs don't even need it, even if they're in a Windows environment, say at work, because... most every application that you'd ever use in Windows is either available for the Mac or there's an equivalent version.
Right, and I've said the same thing for about Linux, too. I mean, everything,
definitely.
You know, people think, oh, Linux doesn't have any software for it. You can't play this. You can't play game. Well, no. Yes, you can emulate. You can do all that stuff. Now, everything is becoming interchangeable. Now, what you can't do, and, gee, I wonder why. Now, Linux, you can emulate and run Windows applications. On Mac, you can emulate and run Windows and Linux applications. But guess what? On Microsoft Windows, can you emulate and run Mac? No.
Not that I know of.
Can you emulate and run Unix? No. Well, there's some ports, but there is not emulation. Gee, do you think Microsoft would ever do that? Hell no.
Why would you want to run anything but Windows?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's funny that the rest of the world, the rest of the OS community, is evolving into a unified direction, while Microsoft is still holding on to that, just that monopoly that they have. That's just, we are the center of the universe, and we are not going to, you know. Anyway, that's a whole nother show. Basically, you know, the moral of this story is, and this is the reason I really wanted to spend this time on it, and thank you for doing it, is Macintosh is cool again. It really is. 5 to 10 years ago, it was the biggest joke. I mean, you got to be honest.
Dark ages.
It was the biggest
joke. It
was awful.
You had people, they didn't know what they wanted to do. Honestly, OS X is what I, between the iMacs and the OS X, that's what saved the company.
Yep, the iMacs made them pretty, the eye candy to get people
they
back.
They made them back in the public
and
eye.
And then OS X made them useful again.
Them usable. I mean, OS 9, it's, you know, for all its faults, it was still a really good operating system. It was far more stable than Windows ever dreamed of being. It was far more secure. OS 10 is far more secure than Windows will ever be. But it had its problems. If you had an application crash in OS 9, basically it brought the whole computer down. It didn't have the protected memory. Mm. You didn't really have true multitasking. So if you were, say, in Photoshop or even doing video, you were rendering a huge video file, you basically had to sit there and wait for it to get done. You couldn't do anything else with the computer. With OS 10, I think Windows has some multitasking too. You could be having that chug away in the background doing whatever it is you're doing, but you can go online, check your email, and it doesn't phase it a bit. Mm. And for me, my productivity has just gone through the roof using 10 as opposed to 9. I could do so much more at the same time.
Well, I mean, I guess it's probably a bad metaphor to say this, but it's kind of an equivalent to Windows 95. I mean, it was a huge change in thinking of how the OS, the underlying thought of how the OS works and the nature of it from Windows 3.1 to Windows 95. But it was buggy, it was full of errors, it was full of problems. For all the good things that it brought, it still had crashes and, you know, stuff like that. And it sounds like the same thing.
That's a perfect analogy. In fact, I've actually used that before, explaining it to people. And ironically, I find that Windows users who switch to the Mac now, to OS X, have a far easier time navigating and learning to use OS X than OS 9 users who switch to OS X. If that makes any sense.
Well, I play with it at the CompuSA and Best Buy and some places like that, and you know, I thought it was fairly intuitive. I didn't do anything detailed on it, of course, because I do not own one that I can sit there and hack away at it. But
it's just like anything else, unless you learn, you know, you play with it. That's the only way you'll learn, is to sit there and play with it and see what it can do. And,
right.
But one other thing I will mention too, as far as the hardware goes, is you don't really have to worry about a lot of the things you do with Windows. I have limited experience on PCs, but enough to know that, I mean, basically anything you want to do, you have to really mess with the BIOS. If you want to boot from another, from a CD or another drive, an external drive, with a Mac, you basically just hold down a key when you boot up, and it more or less asks you what you want to boot from.
All right, well, but what about this? What if I wanted to add another hard drive, a second hard drive, because I was running out of space? Is that something that's easy?
If you have, a G4, which you can put on the G4s, you can put up to 4 drives, and the new G5s you have to go down to CompuSA, get an ATA drive, open up the case, slap it in, format it, and you're done.
Now, an ATA drive has to be, is there like some kind of Mac certification, or will any old ATA drive?
Old ATA, and that's a big misconception. People, right. Well, it's a Mac. It will only use a Mac hard drive.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring that up. I had heard that.
It's a Mac hard drive. And you buy G4, it's going to have an IBM or Fujitsu drive in it, and you just go down to CompUSA. PC compatibility, as far as the hardware go, 100%. The same components, the same RAM, the same video cards. I mean, you can't go to... Well, there's a caveat with the video card. You can't go down to CompUSA and buy a Radeon 9500 for Windows and have it work in your Mac. There's specific drivers, and there's a couple specific AGP things that you really have to be Mac-specific. But as far as hard drives, RAM, that's all interchangeable.
So if you're going to do anything like a video card, sound card, something, you should probably do a little research online first, make sure there's drivers.
For a sound card, you really don't need one. I've never known anybody that had to put a sound card in their Mac because they come with one. I mean, there's a sound card integrated into the computer.
But if somebody wanted to...
If you wanted to get like a Sound Blaster or something, yeah.
Hardcore gaming where they wanted digital...
Find out, make sure that there's an OS X specific driver for it. And honestly, a lot of the, say, like the PCI cards that are out there nowadays, like a SCSI card, OS X has a lot of those drivers already built into it. Because I went and got an Adaptec 2906, I think it was, for my scanner. And I put the card in and just booted up the computer, and the scanner just worked. I didn't have to configure it. It just knew that the card was there because the drivers are already built into the operating system. Same thing with printers. You can get basically any USB printer, plug it into an OS X machine, and it's just going to work.
Right. Well, you know, USB and FireWire are just, you know, godsends as far as that goes.
Definitely, definitely.
All right, well, you know what? Again, the moral of the story, Mac is cool. Hackintosh is back. I'll say it like that. The Hackintosh is back. And actually, you and I had talked about this offline. I guess we can mention it. We are actually going to start trying to have a regular Macintosh section in Binary Revolution starting with the next issue, hopefully. So,
There's not just the community. I mean, the iPods now. There's a whole hacking...
Oh, yeah.
...subgenre right there. There's people that are writing entire operating systems for them based on XML.
Well, I think the iPod's cool by itself.
Oh, definitely.
You know, without any hacking. That's a cool item. It's a cool device that works well. A lot of storage, small, portable. It's already a great MP3 player as it is, so...
You can use it as a hard drive as
well.
But,
yeah, the power and the things you can do with that, yeah, if you do some searching on the Internet, you'll find a lot of interesting stuff. You're right. Let's move on to some actual news topics. We don't have too much time left, but I'm going to hit a couple quick things. Like there is... I read this, and this kind of made me a little bit mad. There is a phenomenon, there's a trend going on where companies are starting to pay people. Instead of giving them a paper check, they're actually starting to pay people with a prepaid card or a prepaid debit card or a paycheck card. They have different terms for them. Where they actually give employees a MasterCard or Visa-backed debit card with their money on it every 2 weeks. Or an account on MasterCard Visa where every 2 weeks they just deposit and add money onto it. Have you heard about this before?
Not until you mentioned it before the show, but I have to say that really bothers me.
Well, yeah, when I first read it, I thought it sounded pretty damn cool. I thought it'd be interesting.
On the surface, it does.
It saves you a trip. Like, first of all, the people that they're doing this with are basically minimum wage or low wage employees. So,
okay.
First of all, you know, the market that they're doing this with is very precise.
As far as the bank goes, everywhere I've ever worked, I've had direct deposit.
Right, and you know, even where I work, they're requiring it. They can't legally require it by law, but they try to heavily influence you into getting it, and they say that it's required, even though they couldn't legally back it.
Direct deposit and you will like it.
Yeah, you have no choice. The companies, a couple of the companies using this are McDonald's, Blockbuster, and Sears, and right now over 1 million people are using this. And I think it's big on in California, I think, is where they're really doing a lot of this. And they're expecting it to go to 3.5 million by 2006. So they're actually planning on going ahead with this. Now, the problem with this, because like I said, it sounds great to me. Give me a credit card and, you know, the idea of having a debit card to me, having all my money portable, take it with me wherever I go, swipe it. You know, I like the idea, except for the privacy concerns of it.
That was my issue with it, that they were able to track how you spend your pay.
Now, the privacy concerns, we've well documented those in the past, and But they've been around for years, and they're going to be around. You know, American Express keeps a database and sells it. All the credit card companies, they know what you buy. That's how they sell your names as targeted marketing. They know if you shop at electronic stores, they're going to sell it to electronics companies to send you junk in the mail and get a Best Buy frequent buyer card and programs like that.
I'm trying to figure out why I get all these Adam and Eve catalogs, though. I can't figure that one out.
Oh, yeah, I wonder. Maybe because their logo is the apple, and you use an apple.
Maybe, that could be.
There you go. Don't ask me how I know
that.
Got
on their list, but that's a whole other story.
The bigger problem I have with this one, though, is in the details of it, as it turns out. Well, for example, the whole process of paying somebody on their paycheck, the whole process is there's software behind it, the people that they have to pay to work in benefits and payroll and stuff like that. It averages out that it costs them about $2 for every check that they cut. So if you have lots of employees, $2 a check, you pay them every week, every 2 weeks, whatever, that can add up. That's a cost that the company incurs. Well, all these damn cost-saving measures that everybody's trying to take, they're trying to re-divert costs away from themselves. That's what this, in essence, does. They're able to outsource or use these prepaid cards cheaper than having to cut checks. They can pretty much outsource a lot of the work to MasterCard and Visa as far as the accounting and stuff like that. And it for them, it's much, much cheaper to use it. They end up saving $50 to $100 per year for each employee. $50 to $100 savings for each employee. And when you're, you know, the McDonald's of the world, the Blockbuster, you have a lot of employees that can add up. So from a business standpoint, you can see the idea of say how much money you would save from it. The problem is that the cards themselves, the execution of these cards is such that, okay, you give somebody a card, here's how much you made, and we put it as debit on this card. Well, when they go to try to use that card somewhere, like everybody else, the banks, anybody who has bad banking knows that if you use an ATM from someone else, you're going to get hit with fees. You know, you get hit with a buck from that bank or $2 from that bank and $2 from the owner of the ATM. You know, so they start to pile up. What ends up happening is the people who are getting these cards end up paying such outrageous fees to have this account that they're the ones that end up incurring that you save $50 to $100 for each employee from the company. It ends up costing them, and this is the estimate, this is from Consumer Reports magazine, they estimate that it costs $164 a year in transaction fees average to the employee. Well, so you save $50 to $100 from the employer, but the employee ends up losing $164 of their hard-earned money.
And somebody tried to tell me that shit doesn't roll downhill.
I mean, this is ridiculous. I don't know. You know, it's been a problem in IT world for years now. You can't justify the IT department. They don't make money, per se, in most situations. It's a money pit. You have to have...
But it's a necessary money.
Well, I know, but see, there is that double-edged sword. It's necessary, but the higher-ups, they don't quite understand that. You have to have a computer system to run, you know, well, I'll use my example, a university. You have millions of students. You have to have a computer department to maintain and run all that. You can't do that manually. But at the same time, how can we, on the bottom line, say, hey, this is how much money you spent, you know, how many million on the IT department. What did we get out of it? You can't say, oh, well, we run the university. That's, you know, it's an intangible thing. You can't say, here's the bottom line. We made this many million back for you. It's a money pit. You have to have it, a necessary evil to function. And it's the same with HR department. You have to have people. You have to pay taxes on these people. You have to take care of all the benefits. People run the software, do all the data entry to make sure they're complying with state laws and federal laws and make sure... there's a lot of stuff that goes behind, but you can't justify that cost. You can't say, okay, what did you guys... You know, we paid this much money in salaries to the HR department. What did you get back to us? Well, we paid the employees. You know, it's a necessary evil. Well, yeah, that's true, but just like in IT, when you can't justify it, they start saying, well, you know what, I don't think you need as much money as you say you do. They start cutting, and they cut back your funding, and they cut back your funding. And the same thing could be happening here. They're cutting funding from these things, and they have to start saving money where they can. Well, what that does is it ends up screwing the employees and they are consumers in this particular circumstance, it ends up screwing the employees and passing the cost on to them. Well, they're already low and minimum wage employees anyway. They don't need this extra fees and crap loaded on top of them. That's ridiculous.
And they have no say in it either. That's the thing.
Quit and go somewhere else. You know, that's your only option in such circumstance like that. And, you know, if this keeps taking off like it is, the 3.5, you know how many, they're going to just go from one company that does it to another one. I hope this doesn't take off. I really don't. Or if it does, they need to work out some better deals for the employees. Work out, okay, you're going to put it on the debit card, which, again, I thought it was a good idea at first, in theory. I like the concept. But you got to work out a deal with MasterCard Visa that says, don't charge them these fees. If we're going to do it,
right. Thing, all right, we're going to charge you to get paid.
Yeah, you know, that's another way of looking at it. And that's, God, how tacky is that?
That's wrong. I mean, that's more or less, it goes back to the old, back in the old mining days, the company store.
Yeah. That's pathetic. You'd end up working a week and ended up being deeper in debt.
$4, I mean, for some people, that's like a weekend of overtime just to pay these fees.
I would hurt. $164, that's, jeez. Forget about it. Now, the other thing is, in general, debit cards have been becoming more popular because they are handy. You know, they're convenient. You got it, like I said, I thought it was a good idea at first. I'm waiting for some big announcement, some big news story about some debit card fraud, some kind of hacking, some kind of transaction, something they're going to blame hackers for making fake debit cards and stuff. You know, the credit card writers are cheap. You know, they're out there. They're nothing new. Carters, people who card have been around for a long time. Carters, the information is out there. People know how to program. They know this kind of stuff. I'm waiting. I'm just waiting for...
That hasn't happened yet.
Not yet. I'm just waiting. It could happen tomorrow, and it wouldn't surprise me. It could be a year from now. But I'm expecting sometime... You will see a headline. It's only a matter of time. You will see a headline sometime soon that something happens, that they're going to find a lot of fraud,
right.
They're going to find a lot of...
A card reader, because if you're ordering stuff online, it doesn't know whether it's a debit card or not. If it's a Visa debit card from a check card from your bank, it's a Visa card. It's got a Visa number.
Some of the sophisticated ones do, actually. Some of the more sophisticated ones do, because those first six numbers are... Well, without going into a lot of detail, those first numbers usually indicate what type of account it is, and you can sometimes tell from the structure of the numbers what kind of card it is. Now, whether or not they have software smart enough to check it on their end, or whether they're running some old software or some custom software and stuff, that's a whole other issue. But
all you really need is a number, though, and you can run up somebody's account online very easily, and that's kind of scary.
Well, there are still, I don't condone, I'm not condoning the use of them, but there are still, to this day, programs that will generate valid credit card numbers, you know? So you don't need the card itself physically. I'm predicting that the physical cards, people are going to start making fake counterfeit debit cards. That's what I foresee. So, but you know...
Any ideas, kids?
Yeah, no, we're not condoning, we're not saying going there, but... I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't happen in their future.
Like, I'm actually surprised that someone that hasn't happened yet.
And you know that it might actually end up being those disgruntled employees that research and do this kind of stuff, because
that's a very good point.
You know, when you rip people, it's just like I'm not going to go into an RIAA rant.
They have very much to lose, and you still take from them, then they kind of get desperate. And
it's like the RIAA. I hate harping on it. I'm not going to go into it, but you rip consumers off for years and years and years with the price of CDs, and finally the consumer said, you know what, fuck you, we've had enough, and they used their technical ability and they got back, and now you have MP3s taking off like they did, peer-to-peer file sharing, people making their own. They took and empowered themselves and took it back, and you're going to rip off your employees, which again, they're sort of a consumer in this circumstance. They are going to become disgruntled, and they're going to say, you know what, I want my $164 back. I should have $164 more in my paycheck per year, and that's just not right. And, you know...
And they have every right to feel that way.
Yeah, I completely understand. I really do. I really do. Hopefully, like I said, that will not take off, but predictions are that that's the way things are going. So, I don't know. And you know what? We're probably long on time, but I'm gonna end on a happier, a funnier note. Well, actually, I don't know how funny this ends up on, but a New York man pleaded guilty to installing keystroke recording software in terminals at over a dozen Kinko's stores. Well, gee, we come first full circle. We started off talking about Kinko's, now we're back to Kinko's again. He gained personal information from over 450 users and opened bank accounts using the data.
Wow.
Now, of course, the term hacker. You know, actually, I kind of laughed at this. I thought it was actually interesting. It was kind of funny until I got up to that whole creating fake bank accounts thing. That's where it lost me. That's kind of pissed me off across the line, obviously. But up until then, it's like, okay, you know, keystroke recording, that's been going around for years. We've done that. Recording keystrokes is a way that you find out passwords and stuff like that. There's hardware recorders, software recorders. This is nothing new. It's just kind of funny that somebody got caught at it. But then again, what he was doing with it, that's where I didn't like it. So it's kind of a lighter note. It's kind of a funny story. But there's, you know, there's a moral here. There's a warning. If you go to, well, not only to Kinko's, but to any public place. Like, you know who the most vulnerable would be? Like those cyber cafes, those internet cafes. Those would be the most vulnerable, the easiest, probably. You really need to be careful. But any public kiosk, any publicly accessible kiosk, be careful. You know, there's no harm in turning and looking and see if there's any unusual hardware. See if there's a hardware recorder. If there's a software keystroke recorder, there's not really too much you can do about it. If it's been planted on there, you know, unless you really look hard, you might not be able to find that. But, you know, you never hack from a public place. You never go out and give private information, credit card stuff from those type of locations,
right,
anyway.
I always tell people, good rule of thumb on that is, like, don't, if you're using a public computer, don't do anything that you wouldn't want anyone else to know.
Absolutely. I mean, most hackers know that.
Yeah.
Most hackers know that. This is, you know, this is just, you know, preaching to the choir. But, yeah, I mean, to people out there who are listening who are not, you know, hadn't thought this through, or who do not consider themselves hackers, yeah, you got to think these things out. Don't do something that you don't want to be caught. Anything that you do, you have to have the mindset that if you're in a public place, well, I guess there's no other way to say it. If you're in a public place, you're in a public place, and you have to behave as such. Anything that you do in a public place, you have to assume, whether you are or are not, you have to assume that, A, you're being watched or recorded, whether it's on film, cameras, something like that, security, and that holds true for the internet as well. You have to assume that everything's being logged, transactions, data, and everything is being watched. You know, it's 1984.
Totally.
It's 2004, 20 years off. You know, it's almost 2004 in a few more months, and Big Brother is watching. Little Brother is watching, I guess a better term. The Little Brothers are all watching. So, anyway, that was kind of an interesting little tidbit. So,
think across state lines.
Yeah. You know, one time, I read this article about this ATM, and it was spitting money into the street.
That was me!
That was me, dude! That was me! No, okay. We're going to close it up for this episode. I don't know how much we're on time. We're probably well over. But I'm going to wrap it up now. You have any shout-outs you want to give?
I want to give shouts to everybody in DDP. You guys are awesome, and thanks for all the great feedback on BinRev. And definite big shouts to my friend Sony. You're awesome, girl.
Yep, shout-out. And I mean, we're going to both smoke up each other's ass. I have to throw it back to you. I mean, you know, again, I feel like I'm pushing a lot of work on you because I know it's hard and takes time, so I appreciate that.
Honestly, Stank, that's the nature of the business. I'm used to it. It's not work. It's not stress. It's a blast.
Well, I don't know what we'd do without you. So, I get a shout out to Cy Pete again. I mentioned earlier that I had I thought one of the best meetings because we actually walked through doing something, and it wasn't like a formal, fancy presentation. It was just a hey, let's do this kind of thing. I had a good time at the meeting. We had quite a few people. Surprising interest in the magazine is growing at my meeting. At first, it was kind of like, oh yeah, somebody else trying to start a zine, somebody else trying to. You know, there's more interest this time, and hopefully, it'll continue to grow. So, shout outs to all of my Broward 2600 meeting. Shouts to Decoder, actually. I had a good talk with him on the con. So thanks a lot to Decoder for hooking up the conference call. I'm going to try to start doing that regularly on the weekends when I have free weekend minutes on the old cell phone. So shouts to him. Of course, I always mention at the end of the show, if you have feedback, letters@benrev.com. And, you know, again, the gentleman who, the anonymous person earlier who was interested in the Dreamcast, I really would like you to get back and follow up with me and tell me, you know, what you found out and if you were able to get this working.
Oh, if he has an article, I already got some great graphic ideas for that. If you can get that up and running.
Great. That would be awesome. So, again, shout-outs to everyone that you mentioned. And do you have any other closing comments?
Well, just thanks for having me on the show, Stan. It's been
awesome. Oh, no. We're going to try to get you on more often. And, you know, we talk about, I know you have a lot of Mac, and there's just so many Mac questions and not enough time to do it, so we're definitely going to be talking about that in some future episodes, so we're definitely going to have you back on. It's just got to work out the timing of when, because you and I, we both work a lot and getting those hours settled out, so we're definitely going to work you in the show more.
Well, it's real world stuff, really gets boring.
Yeah, I know, doesn't it though? But some reason it's just, it never goes away.
Yeah.
Alright, and tonight's closing music is Mr. Roy, Shake Your Body, Mommy, and that'll do it. So, to everybody listening, you know how we end it. See you next week, same hack time.
Same hack channel.